It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Pittsburgh City Council could take a major step next week to help address the lack of affordable housing in the city. Also, the number of students using on-campus mental health services has jumped sharply in recent years. How are Pittsburgh area colleges and universities working to provide the services to students in crisis? That's later in the program. But first, today's the last day to enroll in health insurance plans through the Affordable Care Act. Another 44,000 Pennsylvanians signed up for individual health insurance plans on the marketplace last week. Meanwhile, more and more states are running out of money for their children's health insurance programs because Congress did not reauthorize funding at the end of September. We're going to discuss and cut through some of the confusion about health care for Pennsylvanians with Chris Mamula and Kate Giamarisi, both from the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, and WESA's health and science reporter Sarah Bowden. Welcome, everyone.
Hello.
Thank you. Hi, Kevin.
As always, your input is encouraged. Tweet us your comments and questions. Use the hashtag WESAConfluence. All right, to begin, Republicans are still trying to dismantle the Affordable Care Act, one effort to eliminate one of its most criticized provisions, the individual mandate requiring Americans to have health insurance at any level or face a fine. The GOP has tacked an amendment that would kill the mandate in their tax reform plan. They also aren't renewing federal funding for CHIP programs. So are these being tied together intentionally, or did they just come about? Kate, let's start with you.
So as you mentioned, the Children's Health Insurance Program needed to be reauthorized. The funding for it needed to be reauthorized by Congress by September 30th. And I think most advocates agree one of the reasons why they didn't meet that September 30th deadline is because in September, Congress basically got caught up in one of their last-ditch efforts to dismantle the Affordable Care Act through the Graham-Cassidy bill. They have said that they will get around to doing CHIP, to authorizing that funding. But some of the advocates I've spoken to are hopeful that it would happen by December 22nd. But it hasn't happened yet.
They're kind of separate issues, but they're very related. You know, you can, as Kate has mentioned, even in the same families, you can have the parents insured by an Affordable Care Act policy and children receiving CHIP benefits. So,
yeah, and I spoke to several families that were in that situation.
Sarah?
Yeah, that's accurate.
Yes. So is there a holdup on CHIP? Is it over the amount of money from the federal government? Are there provisions they want to add to limit it? Or what is the holdup?
Well, so there's been basically some, I would say, partisan bickering over how the program would be paid for and what, you know, if there would be cuts in certain other healthcare related areas to pay for the CHIP funding. Historically, this is a program that does have a lot of bipartisan support and a lot of bipartisan consensus. And I think it's, you know, a lot of the people that I've spoken to are pretty disappointed to see what's happening now. And, you know, this is people, I spoke to people back in September who said, you know, if we don't get this, if this doesn't happen by the deadline by September 30th, you know, what's happening now is exactly what people feared, that it gets caught up in partisan fighting.
And some states have sent out letters saying, like, CHIP is going away, and now there's some kind of holdover funding, is my understanding.
I believe that in their most recent continuing resolution, they sort of moved some money around for certain states to make it a little bit easier for those states to access funding. And, Pennsylvania is not in as dire of straits as some other states. I believe a couple other states have sent out, 30-day notice letters. We're not in that situation yet.
Confusion and a lot of angst, and it's just a lot of scared feelings.
Okay. So going into this final week of the open enrollment period, as I mentioned, there were about 206,000 people signed up since the open enrollment began November 1st, Pennsylvania numbers there. Last year, it was more than double that. So we won't have final numbers for a handful of days, but any sense of why so many fewer people signed up this year?
Kevin, I think there's some real confusion about whether or not the penalty for not having insurance is being enforced. The money for the navigators, for the folks who are helping people get signed up, has been cut significantly. And also the enrollment period has been dramatically cut. So all of those things, a lot of the things that are happening in Washington, the confusion, I think, has accounted for that.
Yeah, I think the open enrollment period being half the length of previous open enrollment periods has really hurt numbers, even though they've been more robust week by week. I would be shocked if we, the ACA, saw enrollment at the end of this period that was anywhere near what it was last year.
I think that's true. I think some of the predictions are that it'll be under what it was in past years already.
Is it possible for the lower numbers at this point, that people might be selecting non-Obamacare insurance because some are finding premiums might be lower off the exchanges?
That's certainly possible. It's hard to say, like, if that's to account for the total, like, I guess, smaller number that we'll probably see this year compared to last year. But people are finding more affordable Obamacare compliant plans that are not on the market.
It depends on income, I think. Like 57% of the people in Pennsylvania who have an Affordable Care Act coverage or plan get some kind of assistance, get the supports. So it just depends.
And if you have subsidies are way higher this year. So yeah, you're probably finding a pretty good plan if you have subsidies on the marketplace. But especially if you don't have subsidies, you really should be shopping off the marketplace.
We talked with Ron Ruman. He's with the Pennsylvania Department of Insurance. He said that 20% of those who use the Obamacare exchange don't qualify for any subsidy.
Premiums on silver plans increased almost 31% for 2018 because the Trump administration ended cost-sharing reduction payments, which were payments made to insurers to help cover out-of-pocket costs for lower-income customers, deductibles, and co-pays. These are costs the insurers are still responsible for under the law, but they're not going to get reimbursement from the government now.
Okay, he mentioned silver plans. Very briefly, gold, silver, and bronze, what's the difference?
They're just different gradations or different offerings under each one. A gold plan, for example, might be what they used to call first dollar coverage. It's the very best you can get. And a bronze plan would not be as good. Maybe the deductibles would be much higher than the silver plans. The silver plans are generally the most popular. They're kind of like a benchmark or standard plan.
Yeah, and I want to say I misspoke. People who don't get subsidies should be shopping on and off the marketplace, but they should definitely look up plans on the marketplace if you're still looking for a plan. But I would describe a silver plan as a very middle-of-the-road plan where you can tolerate some risk, but you don't want to get slammed with a really high deductible.
Okay, did I hear that some silver plans are actually more expensive than the gold plans, in a sense, for the individual? And the second part of this is, what's this term we're hearing about silver loading?
Silver loading. So, okay, it is a bananas year this year. I just got to say, it's bananas. So because the Trump administration ended the cost-sharing reduction payments to vendors on the marketplace, and these made silver plans more affordable to people with lower incomes. So what the insurance companies did is they raised the silver plan price, and that made the silver plan price so high that actually gold is more affordable, even though it's a more generous plan.
Okay, I'm shaking my head at that one, though.
That's an excellent understanding of it. It's beyond what I can understand with it.
Okay, so now on the other hand, so we have gold plans, silver, bronze. What is this regarding skinny health insurance? President Trump has been promoting this. What's the difference here, Chris?
The goal, what the president is supporting, and is supporting health plans that don't have to meet the basic conditions or the basic benefits of a health plan. So today we have the Affordable Care Act plans. You have to have basic. You have to cover mental health, you have to cover free physicals, your children can stay on the plan until their 20s. He wants to allow insurers to just do away with those those standards. So if you want to get health coverage, you can buy coverage that doesn't meet that. The danger in doing that is that the consumer can be confused, thinking that they have a plan that's going to take care of them if they're in the hospital or something like that. And these plans are called skinny for a reason, because they don't have nearly the same coverage.
Yeah, it's dangerous. I mean, some people say it's pretty dangerous. Like, you break a leg, that could really wipe up your finances, and these skinny plans probably won't cover too much, if any, because very high deductibles.
So the cost of the premiums, do we have a sense of this year in the Affordable Care Act marketplace, how much have they gone up? How much have they gone up? How much more in general are people paying?
The cost increases for what the consumers are seeing has not appreciably increased. What has increased is the cost for not having the subsidies. It's almost like, yeah, they're up 30%, but that's because the plans are higher, the supports, the subsidies are higher. Mm-hmm. So for the most part, consumers are not seeing huge increases. Ron just talked about the 31% increase. Yes, they're up 31%, but that's not what consumers are seeing. In fact, there are plans out there with zero premiums. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So it's only certain. It's the difference of having the money or not. You know, for the subsidies, consumers aren't being impacted in a big way. The federal government is, but not the consumer.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA, and we're talking about the last day to sign up was Friday for the affordable health care plans under the Obamacare marketplace. And we're also talking about CHIP. CHIP is still not funded, although, Kate, this week, I believe it was this week, Pennsylvania legislature reauthorized the Pennsylvania's plan. Really, what good does that do when most of the money, I believe, for CHIP comes from the federal government?
Well, so that's correct. Pennsylvania, its legislature had to reauthorize this, and I believe the governor is going to be signing that bill like right now as we speak. He's doing it today. And that is something that had to happen, but you're correct. Really, the major action that we're still waiting for here is from the federal government, is from Congress.
Is there much of a breakdown of funding? Did I hear as much as 90% comes from?
Yeah, I believe it's 90% federally funded. So that's really the bulk of the funds.
Todd Wolin is a Pittsburgh pediatrician, and he told NPR that parents, even in Pennsylvania, are panicking.
Parents are literally telling us they don't know what to do. I mean, they make too much to get Medicaid, and they don't have jobs or earn enough to get the commercial insurance. I don't know what to tell them to do.
All right, Kate, are you hearing that when you talk to people?
Well, yeah, I mean, I spoke to three moms recently whose children are all covered by CHIP, and yeah, obviously, they're very upset. They're very concerned. They're calling on Congress to basically fund this program. The state has said, they won't, they're going to keep going as long as they can. They haven't given exactly a drop dead deadline, but they've said, February, sometimes they've said in the first quarter of next year. They have also said that they would give people at least 30 days notice before ending any coverage, and they would hopefully be able to direct people to for instance, some people might be able to qualify for a special enrollment period to be able to try and buy insurance for their children on the exchange. Of course, people are very concerned. Who wouldn't be in this situation?
And parents are having to make, or might have to make, very critical decisions where they can afford to buy insurance for their children.
I mean, that they might be faced with that. I mean, hopefully it won't come to that. And I should also say, for anyone who's listening, whose children are covered, the state has a website with quite a lot of helpful information. It's chipcoverspakids.com, and they have a lot of answers to frequently asked questions. I mean, they have been emphatic that, in the meantime, you can go to the doctor as normal. If you get a renewal notice, you should renew it. If you pay a premium, because some higher income families do pay a premium, they said continue to pay it as normal. But yeah, I mean, I know that the State Department of Human Services has a team that's basically meeting quite frequently on this to basically, you know, stay as up to the minute as they can on how do they manage this.
And we talked to a Pittsburgh area mom. You mentioned you talked to some parents as well. And she said, okay, if I buy insurance, and am I going to get the high, very high copay? And is it worth it to maybe it's $100 copay and my child has a cold, or do they have something worse? And it's like that decision, and you really don't want to make that decision. You want your child to go to the doctor.
Yeah, I mean, of course, it's tough. I mean, I spoke with a woman who her son is on CHIP. Her job does offer health insurance, but it's far too expensive. I mean, it's just hundreds of dollars a month that she doesn't really have. And I mean, you know, she was telling me she has a young son. Little boys love to run around and jump off things. And she was just, she doesn't want to be without insurance, of course.
Those high deductibles have been a deterrent for people to use healthcare services, even when they were covered. I think that's been shown. So I think people will see the deductibles, and just like you say, they have that second thought right off the bat, even if it's children or adults.
So there's a lot of confusion about CHIP. There's a lot of confusion all around, and there's confusion, I understand, Sarah, about the funding for the federally qualified community health centers. Yep. What are these centers? What do they do, and who are their clients?
Yeah, so these community health centers, more formally or officially known as federally qualified community health centers, are they cover medically underserved populations. So that could be low-income people, communities either rural or urban where there just aren't a lot of medical resources. And one of the requirements for these clinics is that they have to provide services on a sliding scale, and they can't turn anyone away. And 70% of their federal grant funding hasn't been reauthorized like CHIP. It also lapsed on the 30th. And the grant cycles are, you know, it kind of tapers, but at least a quarter of these clinics, including the Squirrel Hill Clinic here in Pittsburgh, they run out of their grant funding on January 1st. And so there is some month-to-month stopgap funding, but this is kind of a confusing way to plan for the future. For example, Squirrel Hill has a pilot opioid project that they want to start, and they don't know what to do about that. Do they continue? Do they hire up staff? Do they do a hiring freeze? Or they're saying if this grant funding goes the way, they'll have to close the site. It's a confusing way to run a business when they don't know where the money's coming from month to month and if it's going to be there.
So these centers, understand, they're telling people about how much they need, but do the numbers match? Is it a smart move on their part? And the final part of that question is, these are, some of their clients are actually CHIP kids, right?
Some of their clients are CHIP kids. A lot of their clients, their largest source of revenue is Medicaid. So Medicaid population, again, low income. So it's very much like a medical safety net. So if and these are generally like very popular. There's bipartisan support going back decades. There was a lot of funding that increased during the ACA, but these community health centers have been popular for decades and decades. There's practically one in nearly every congressional district.
Okay. We have just a couple of minutes left, and I want to get to some things. Now, Kate, I believe you said that there's the possibility that there might be some action on CHIP next week in the around the 22nd. Is that correct?
So my understanding is that it would be included in a – there needs to be, like, continuing reauthorization to keep the government functioning and to, you know, keep the government running, and it could be part of that. I just spoke to someone this morning, though, who was, you know, pretty distressed to see that this was, again, as I said before, it's being tied to other more partisan issues and really not being renewed on its own merits. But yes, we'll have to wait and see what happens next week.
Chris, quickly, I wanted to ask you, if the individual mandate penalty for not acquiring insurance is included in the final tax reform bill and it is passed, what is that going to do with the ACA?
I don't think we can underestimate the damage that that would do. It it would bring chaos to the market, in more chaos, I guess, and more confusion than there is already. But basically, what you would be doing is driving away healthy young people from the ACA market, because they wouldn't have to have it. And then what's left are older, a pool of people who are older, sicker, who need the medical care. It would be a terrific disruption. It could be the fatal blow for the Affordable Care Act.
Okay. And to Kate and Sarah, 20 seconds each, what are you going to be keeping your eye on in your particular areas in the next days and weeks ahead and what you're covering?
Well, so certainly we're going to pay attention to what happens with CHIP and this other health center funding. But, you know, one thing I just want to emphasize again, which I know we sort of touched on earlier, is these programs, even though we're talking about separate programs, they do all work in concert together and can serve, you know, different members of the same household. So,
yeah, I want to see if this funding isn't reauthorized, how health centers are going to start budgeting for the new year.
Sarah Bowden is WESA's health and science reporter. Chris Mamula and Kate Giamarisi are reporters with the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Thanks all for coming in.
Thank you, Kevin.
Thank you.
Pittsburgh City Council takes a step forward easing the affordable housing crisis. That's next on The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
Here's what's trending in Pittsburgh. I'm Sarah Kovash. Local Toys for Tots volunteers are trying to break down gender stereotypes by swapping traditionally boys and girls toys. The organization's local branch gave out nearly 130,000 toys last year. And new development could be coming to Pittsburgh's riverfronts. The Department of City Planning hopes to rezone those areas and held several public meetings to gather input on what residents would like to see along the rivers. Find more at WESA.FM.
It's The Confluence, where the news comes together. I'm Kevin Gavin. Last year at this time, City Council, through legislation, created the Housing Opportunity Fund to provide more affordable options for Pittsburgh's booming real estate and rental market. 12 months later, they might have finally found a way to actually pay for it. In studio to help us understand how it could help are Margaret J. Krause, WESA's development and infrastructure reporter, and Ann Lee Herring, WESA's government and law reporter. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Kevin.
Your questions and comments, of course, are always welcome. Please tweet them, and you can use the hashtag WESAConfluence. All right, your average working-class Pittsburgher might have a very different definition of affordable housing than other city residents, maybe pulling in $75,000 or more a year. Is there an agreed-upon definition of affordable housing, especially in context with the Housing Opportunity Fund?
Well, I mean, affordable housing does have a federal government definition. Low to moderate income carries actual income levels. But I actually am not sure whether our legislation includes specifications about who this will be for in terms of median income and what percentage of it.
Well, I know that the Affordable Housing Task Force, which conducted a study assessing the need for affordable housing in Pittsburgh in 2016, was using 50% of the area median income as their baseline for deciding which households are in need of housing and assessing what that gap is.
And at that time, using that, that was the ceiling for eligibility? Is that what they were using?
That's right. That's what I believe.
Okay. Now, so I've heard various politicians also talk about how much affordable housing is needed. I've heard as many as 17,000 units. Do we have a good handle on really what is the demand? What is the need?
An inventory that was done actually put it at least 17,000. So that's a floor. We just talked about a ceiling. That's the floor, that Pittsburgh is short 17,000 units of affordable housing.
Okay. So on the Pittsburgh City Council this week took preliminary action. What are the key components of how the Housing Opportunity Fund would be fed, how it would be funded?
Yes. So initially, over the next 2 years, so in 2018 and 2019, the realty transfer tax, which is a one-time tax applied to all home sales, would rise from 4% to 4.5%. And then following that, in 2020, that tax would go up to 5%. The reason that this tax increase can be phased in is that some of the council members identified unused revenues in the city budget and proposed shrinking some trust funds that the city has for things like worker compensation settlements, so they're able to allow for a more gradual increase.
And earlier this year, there was a proposal to actually do the full percentage point immediately, correct?
That's right. Council members Lavelle and Ricky Burgess proposed that, and there was a lot of resistance on council. They couldn't get majority support. There was concern about the impact it would have on home sales.
Okay. Preliminary vote was, I believe, 7-2. Who opposed and why?
The two who voted against this bill were council members Natalia Rudiak and Darlene Harris. And the reason they were opposed is that they don't think that it makes much sense to make housing more expensive in order to finance an affordable housing fund.
And I think there has been, I was at a meeting about the Pittsburgh Land Bank yesterday, and there was agreement basically that everyone knows that we need to create a more affordable housing and enable more affordable housing. That's clear. And the Housing Opportunity Fund hasn't been funded for a year. The land bank doesn't yet have funding in terms of how it will get its initial launch. But people are saying we have to do this. We have to do it now. And there is this central disagreement of, do we make life more expensive to make it more affordable?
I spoke with Mayor Peduto about this earlier this week, and he was praising City Council for coming up with the funding plan, but he also said he wanted to make sure that he didn't want to see that people were having to leave their neighborhoods in an effort to create more affordable housing.
To be certain, it's happened in areas like East Liberty. It's happened in areas like Lawrenceville and in Shadyside, the South Side. And we have 90 neighborhoods, and we want to make sure that they get to see and be a part of this economic growth, but not at the expense of the people that live there now.
He cited a couple of areas that have been really points of contention, and they want to avoid that angst and criticism in the future, don't they?
Well, I think it's sometimes easy to forget that when we talk about the numbers of units needed, the amount of money needed, that we're talking about homes, not just houses. These are people's lives that are often disrupted when prices go up. People are priced out of their neighborhoods, maybe with an increase of property tax or with an increase of the realty transfer tax, although I can't speak to that causal relationship. And there's the former Penn Plaza site that was demolished to make way for a new development, I think really brought this discussion of how affordable housing is needed to the fore. But there are a variety of tools that the city and city council have begun working on that are not yet all firing. And so to see them come online one by one is probably more difficult than if somehow you could do them all at once.
Okay, we have about 90 seconds left. So when might we see the first people benefiting from this Housing Opportunity Fund?
That's really hard to say. From what I've seen, the tax wouldn't be the tax increase wouldn't right. be implemented until February. And then it's a question of how the fund will be used. Council member Gilman proposed a bill that would draw on the fund to help first-time home buyers make down payments. So that's one area where you may initially see the benefit here.
Margaret, real quickly, the mayor also said he'd like to see a program in place to turn over blighted properties to nonprofits to fix them up and sell them to buyers. Now, would this be part of the Housing Opportunity Fund, or would this be part of the land bank, or what, or just the broader picture of creating some more affordable housing?
Well, I think creating affordable housing will require agency cooperation, both between the city and its agencies and nonprofit corporations like the land bank. But the land bank hasn't yet been approved in terms of operation, so I believe that remains to be seen and could be worked out in legislation council produces.
And one more thing for Unley. You were there when the hearing and was discussed. Realtors are opposed to this increase. I guess no surprise, but what's their main point?
They're concerned about the costs that this is going to create for home buyers. I mean, think about a home that's valued at $150,000. That tax would be about $7,500 once it goes up to 5%. So it's a real concern that it'll push home buyers outside the city to surrounding municipalities.
Final vote, I believe, is Tuesday?
That's what I hear.
All right. Anli Herring is WESA's government law reporter. Margaret J. Krause is WESA's development and infrastructure reporter. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thanks, Kevin.
Coming up, Pittsburgh area colleges and universities dealing with an increasing demand for mental health services for their students. That's when the Confluence continues on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Katie Blackley with the Pittsburgh Almanac. This week in history, the film Pittsburgh, starring Marlena Dietrich and John Wayne, premieres in 1942. The drama features Wayne playing Charles, a.k.a. Pittsburgh, Markham, as a coal miner trying to rise to the top.
Speakeasies and mansions in Pittsburgh's roaring 20s, when two Huskies fought a city and each other for the favor of a woman.
Part of the movie was filmed on location in the city. That's this week's Pittsburgh Almanac for December 15th, 2017.
It's the confluence where the news comes together. I'm Kevin Gavin. At Point Park University, demand to see a mental health counselor has increased so much that wait times per session have jumped from a few days to 2 to 3 weeks and even longer. And Point Park is not alone. Joining us in studio is Matt Petras, a current senior at Point Park University, who's been covering the issue for Public Source. Great to have you here, Matt.
Thank you for having me.
And you're welcome to join the conversation. You can tweet us your comments or questions using the hashtag WESAConfluence. Matt, speaking broadly, what is offered to college students seeking mental health services, and what are the challenges to actually receiving that care?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we looked at eight colleges based in Pittsburgh, the Pittsburgh area, and all of which were four-year colleges and nonprofit colleges. And what's certainly in common is that they all do offer mental health counseling on campus that you can receive for free. And this just sort of comes with, you know, being a student. But there are a lot of, you know, you asked, you know, what's the broad answer? The more complicated answer is that what exactly is offered and how much access and how what the access looks like at each college differs when it comes to issues like wait times and even if part-time students are able to access these services and et cetera.
So why is this conversation important on college campuses in particular?
Well, college campuses, you know, a lot of these students who attend these colleges are sort of living on their own for the first time, and they, you know, they're not used to sort of getting themselves help when they need it, and they're, you know, in a situation where, you know, they're living on their own for the first time, maybe for some of them, and others, you know, they're just sort of taking on a lot more responsibility than that takes. And that also, you know, that brings a lot of stressors that are going to be new to them. But what's the case for many of these students who are using these services is that they've suffered with issues like depression and anxiety and other things along those lines for much of their life.
So you're used to being maybe surrounded by family in a comfortable home environment, sort of your own safety net and your friends. And now it's the freedom of living on your own, being by yourself, but then, as you say, the stressors.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. It's tough. And it's a, you know, college students are sort of in many ways sort of in a vulnerable situation here. And I think it's most people expect colleges to be able to sort of aid students and to help them out to make sure that, you know, they're on their way to, you know, being the person they want to be and growing, because that's, you know, that's what college is about.
Did you find other stressors other than being on your own? Is it just the academic demands? Any other stressors that you learned about?
Well, again, I think probably most prominent is just the fact that students just have, you know, mental health issues. They have these clinical issues where, you know, they have depression, they have anxiety. And for many people, those are just, you know, issues that they just have, that there's not necessarily a grand reason for. They just suffer from these issues.
Did you get a sense of why the increase? Because it's been this fairly significant increase, and it's not just at any one school per se, correct?
Right. No, this is a national issue, and this is just one small piece of it here in Pittsburgh. I think that the consensus for why the increase has happened and why it's so stark is not that any more students are any more depressed or anxious or troubled than they have been in the past, but just that the awareness has increased, that people are realizing that, you know, there's something wrong, that they need help, and you know, they're coming forward and they're getting that help.
I mentioned wait times at the beginning of our conversation. The difference in wait times and access to qualified counseling, different across universities. In your reporting, through your research, through your interviews, did you get a sense of which schools are doing it right and which ones are maybe experiencing more demand for the services?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so if you look in the piece that people can access on publicsource.org, at the bottom of it is these sort of graphics that we made that sort of outline all of these things, all of these differences, and so you can check it out for yourselves. It seems like when it comes to wait times, the schools that were reporting the highest wait times were Duquesne and Point Park. And then schools that were reporting some of the much, much smaller ones, I remember being, off the top of my head, I remember La Roche had very short ones, but they're also a campus with a much smaller student body than a lot of these schools. So that's also something important to keep in mind.
Part of the problem, could it be the number of professionals compared to the students? The ratio is just too big?
Yeah, and that was another big issue that was explored in the story, is that there is some dispute over, you know, how staffed these counseling departments should be. Many of these schools, most of them that we surveyed, use student trainees to help with counseling, but they're sort of limited in what they can offer because of the fact that they're not licensed and they're still in training. At Point Park, in fact, there was only one licensed counselor. It's the only college there that only has just one.
Did somebody resign from Point Park?
Yes. So throughout the course of my reporting, there was a resignation from Taffy Busey, who is the director of counseling services at Point Park. She was there for about 2 years, and she her resignation goes into effect beginning of February next year.
And that's interesting. Maybe the stress is also on these few workers having to deal with an increase in young adults being stressed by college life.
Yeah, for sure. And it's a difficult situation. And what she sort of said in the quotes that appear in the article is that, you know, it is tough to sort of to be in a situation where, you know, there are these students who are suffering and need help, and there's just only so much you can do.
What does what message does her departure send to Point Park students who need help?
I think it shows that it's a good question. I think that's going to be up for the listeners to decide. But I think that at the end of the day, it shows that there's a big demand for this sort of thing, and you need to come up with the staff to reach it, because this is important stuff.
And very briefly, Matt, the stakes, let's face it, can be very high with students in crisis.
Yes, for sure. Yes. You know, we're dealing with serious stuff here. You know, we're dealing with not just students who are feeling sad. We're dealing with clinical medical issues like depression and anxiety.
You can find Matt Petras's piece on mental health services available to Pittsburgh area college students on publicsource.org. Matt, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And for this week, that's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Our engineer is Tom Hurley. Production assistance and research from Courtney Harrell. The producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good week of good news.